From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Thanks for joining me and Ken Drews for another of our monthly Urgent Garden Question Q&A shows. And it's in fact the 12th in a row, closing our first year of this new feature, which has proven so popular with Away to Garden readers and listeners. So thanks for your support and for your questions, most of all. You can keep them coming anytime in comments or by email using the contact form on awaytogarden.com or kendrews.com or on facebook.com/awaytogarden. This month, I thought we'd theme our conversation to one that many of you ask about in one way or another a lot of the time, including lately, and that's gardening in the shade, a particular expertise of Ken's, who has written two books on the subject.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, made possible from Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books. The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by best-selling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere. From High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company proudly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/awaytogarden.
Ready to tackle some shade questions, Ken?
I'll do my best, Margaret.
You're really sounding prepared. Thanks a lot.
I'm never prepared because you get such good questions.
Oh, I do. I heard, by the way, that you will be lecturing about shade gardening not far from me at Berkshire Botanical Gardens Winter Lecture, a very nice annual event on January 12th in Lenox, Massachusetts. Yes?
Yes. I don't know if it's the 12th or the 13th, but it's in that. I better check that out, huh?
I'll put all the links with the transcript of this show on awaytogarden.com, and we'll give, you know, ticket information for local listeners. And I can come. I'm going to get a ticket. I'm going to come and heckle you and ask rude questions afterward,
great.
Right? That'll be good.
Great.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's what friends are for, hon. So just as a backdrop for people, you've done two shade gardening books, The Natural Shade Garden in 1907 or what year?
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
20th century.
Yeah. No, see, I can't remember the year of The Natural Shade Garden, the first one.
I think
one.
It's, is it like 92? Is
yeah, that, something like that. And then The New Shade Garden, which was just, what, a year or so ago?
Yeah, and that's a totally different book.
Yes, which really takes into account how much has changed on a more global scale, climate-wise,
right,
and the reality of how we're gardening today. So what got you started, just quickly, what got you started on this as sort of a specialty? Did you, like, grow up in a forest or something?
No, you know, people think that I'm an expert. And I guess after I finish writing a book, I kind of am an expert. But I think of myself as a journalist because I usually,
right,
I want to know about a subject and then I discover a lot about it and write about it. But I don't always know about it beforehand. But I had a house in Brooklyn, which I've sold subsequently, and it was in a shady backyard. So
okay,
I needed to know more about shade, and that's how that happened.
Okay. So necessity was the mother again of invention.
Right.
Okay.
I thought laziness was the mother of invention.
So there's, as I said in the introduction, there's always questions about dry shade, and especially the really, some of the trickiest trees to grow things under, conifers being one, and, you know, we can talk about that later maybe. But a couple of questions this week were about the dreaded Norway maple tree.
Yes,
a non-native invasive species of maple. It's proven invasive in many areas, especially the East, that was brought over in, like, the 1700s from Europe, and it kind of backfired eventually, became a popular street tree and yard tree. So we have a couple questions today, as I said, one from another Margaret, a Margaret on Facebook, and one from Valerie in email. And basically one of them just says, what to plant under the dreaded Norway maple? And Valerie gives us sort of some ideas about you know, some of the things she's tried, hostas, sedums, a smoke bush, she says, that should be twice the size by now. You know, so everything is sort of stunted if it grows at all, is what she's saying. And mm-hmm, she's really almost at the point, she says, where she's ready to just plant thugs, you know, herbaceous thugs, like things that are practically invasive or invasive themselves to compete with it. And obviously, we don't want to recommend that. So Norway maple, is this something that comes up a lot when you lecture and so forth?
Yes, it does. And they're terrible plants and have been banned in certain, in some states.
Yes.
And in New York City, they can't plant them anymore. And people ask me about that a lot. And I don't know where this person lives. Did she mention that?
She's zone 6, I think. Well, there's two different people. They're both zone 6, right, but in different spots. Yeah, but eastern.
Well, when people ask me about that, because the roots are so shallow of the Norway maple and the shade that it produces, they're almost like overlapping black shingles, the leaves. So it's the shade is so dense, the soil is so dry, and as you know, Norway maple has an allelopathic, is that the right word?
Yeah, it sort of exudes a chemical that
inhibits the growth of other plants.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about that, though, is the papers lately in the journals keep... There's some scientists who say yay and some who say nay on that. You know, they're saying, the studies don't really bear it out. But yes, it seems allelopathic in the sense that it's this like wasteland under there.
Right.
But we're thinking maybe not. Maybe it's just what you just said, the dense shade and these surface roots. And then, it, of course, it's a rampant producer of seeds, right? I mean,
oh,
it just,
terrible.
Yeah. And so those themselves are another form of competition. So the allelopathic thing, I think, is a under dispute, but who knows?
Well, and also they drop their leaves later than the native trees. So they're, you can drive through the, you know, by on Route 95 in Connecticut, and you can see all these yellow leafed maple trees, and long gone are the sugar maples. So that's another bad thing that happens. But what I say to people in this kind of situation and what I've done, especially under maples, is plant containers.
Right.
So you get containers, you elevate them on a couple of bricks so they're not directly on the roots of the trees above and below. The roots are below. And there's a lot of things that you can plant. I usually choose plants from a zone that's one zone colder than the one that I'm in. So if you have hostas that are cold tolerant, although that they need a little more light. So you really need some shade tolerant plants, but they can be annuals if you can find them, perennials. I don't think there's a whole lot of woody plants that are going to like that too much, but they're, you know, you can try it. So I would say planting containers, just think about an elevated garden in that terrible situation.
So staging, and these have to be large containers because if you're in a cold winter zone and they have to be weatherproof if they're going to stay out, you're saying staging like a vignette or a number of vignettes sort of in that area.
Like you might on a patio or
something.
Make a whole garden,
yeah.
Maybe start by, you know, a half whiskey barrel or some big plastic tubs.
Right, right. You know, I keep wondering if with going back to sort of what Valerie in her question, you know, she was saying she's ready to let go for the invasives. And I think I read, and I can't really even remember where, I read one gardener who was experimenting with this, and his thinking was, well, like, okay, if this is an invasive tree from Europe, well, it wasn't invasive in Europe, but when it came here, it became invasive. What grew around it successfully in the old country, you know, and like kind of looking that up. And it was hard for him to be exactly precise, but I remember that, of course, it turned out, as Valerie was inclined to do. It was like, what do you call the, gout weed and you know, lamium and, you know, stuff that, like, once you've got it, forget about it. You're never getting rid of it. It was stuff that has also become herbaceous stuff that in some cases has become invasive here. So we don't want to go that way, just to be clear. But I keep wondering if, like, you know, I live surrounded by a state park, a lot of woodland, big trees, not Norway's, thankfully. You know, but there's a lot of that old trees with big roots, surface roots, and a lot of shade and dry and so forth. And I see that certain plants seem to just tough it out there, like certain asters, for instance, if you're in the east,
yeah,
like some
true.
Like the big leaf aster, is that Macrophyllus, I think, and Devaricata, the white wood aster. Do you know what I mean? They seem to sometimes just make their way in tough spots. And I wondered if you watered, if you put in small plants and watered carefully as they were getting acclimated, would they maybe take hold like they seem to do at the edge? I'm just extrapolating from the edge of my woods, you know?
I think it's something very important that you said, which was watering. So, you know, a lot of people want to grow native plants and they don't do that well. And they think they're native plants. They should get along by themselves because they do in nature. But
right.
really, you have to establish them. In the beginning, you have to really water them. When I started my woodland garden, which is under a white pine, a moisture-sucking white pine, I covered about a quarter of the soil.
Is that a special species of white pine, moisture-sucking?
Moisture-sucking white pine. So I added some compost to about one quarter of the area under the tree and planted in that, but really watered that first year. And things to try, maybe wild ginger, Azarum canadense,
yes,
Uvularia, Polygonatum, maybe Myanthemum. That's like, well, the Mayflower would probably do it, you know,
yes.
The Myanthemum Mayflower, but maybe even False Solomon Seal. And I know that Christmas fern would do okay, but it would take a long time to look like anything.
Right. So you're mentioning some native, Eastern natives, and they're in various areas native. But you're mentioning things that would, again, like my wondering about those two asters that I see doing their thing at the edge of the woods in tough spots, that would be competing in their native environment. They would be competing frequently with big trees.
We're getting along with.
Getting along with. Okay, sorry. Didn't mean to sound. It was like it was confrontational. I was thinking about the American ginger, Acerum canadense also. That seems to me to be a real doer. It's like a robust kind of ground cover. It's herbaceous. It's not going to give you evergreen cover. But did you say Virginia creeper? Parthenocissus quinquefolia.
No, but
yeah, to me that would go anywhere. It'll go. It seems like
it'll go up the tree and.
Well, but
I don't know.
You know what?
That kind of gets out of control.
Yeah, but it's a super high value wildlife plant, and so she's.
That's true.
You know, I've got a really.
Well, you know, it's funny because I was thinking poison ivy, but we didn't want to get into that.
Right, 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 right.
Super high value wildlife plant that would probably do okay.
Well, and with the Parthenocissus, with the Virginia creeper, and then there's one, I think it's Parthenocissus incerta, the western one, which is, you know, it used to be all one species throughout the whole country, and now it's been subdivided or some crazy thing. But it's super high value. It has gorgeous fall color. It has fruit. You know, so it actually, again, you know, it's not like she's loving, either of these people is loving this tree. Even if it did climb up the tree, birds will nest in it and that'd be okay. And, you know, do you know what I mean? If all else fails.
Do you think it's okay to grow Boston ivy? Do you think that's acceptable to grow a non-native Parthenocissus?
I don't know. I mean, I guess if all else fails. But in these types of woodsy edge kind of environments, I always like to think, well, maybe we should put some of the natives, you know, because there's so much action going on with our wildlife, our birds and our insects, you know, at that sort of edge of the habitat, that sort of, you know, where lower vegetation transitions to bigger, there's so much life usually. So, you know, anyway.
You know, you're talking about plants that can compete and maybe even quote-unquote thugs.
Right.
Under a spruce tree here, I planted ostrich fern, which can really take over. But it's completely naturalized, a dangerous word. It's a native plant.
Yes.
But it's just filled. It's like a tall, 3-foot-tall green lawn, and it's just gorgeous under the spruce. Goes right up to the trunk of the spruce. And it's very beautiful, and it's in a place where I can't really grow anything else and where I don't need to get. And I sort of keep the edge clear, you know, so every year I'll pull up some and either transplant them or throw them out.
Right.
Or mow them, you know, I don't mow them, but if I had
right,
lawn
I know what
there,
you mean. Right.
I would
right.
just mow them.
Ostrich fern is a great.
Because they'll creep.
It's great, and of course you can knock off the first croziers, the first little unfurled fiddleheady things, right? And you can eat them in the spring if you like fiddleheads.
Don't eat too many.
No, but you just can take knock off one from each crown and they'll make more or something.
You know, I wonder if you harvest all of them from the ones that are on the edge that you're going to pull up anyway. I wonder what that would do.
I don't know. It seems like an energetic plant. It'd probably sprout again. But it's a beautiful, it's so romantic. It's such a beautiful plant. I think it's a good idea. So in getting those started, though, again, you're going to, even with a tough plant like that, you're going to have to give it some watering. You're not going to want to build up the soil. Like, an answer for growing under trees is not like bringing in, quote, topsoil, and that's not what we do, because that's bad for the tree. Not that we love this Norway maple again, but we're not going to do that. We did have another sort of watering question and brought up that I was going to save till later, but since you brought up the sort of, you know, caring for things as they're transitioning, Peter on Facebook asked, and he's worried about a native garden in dry shade that's still getting established, and he wonders if in winter it's going to get enough moisture, and, you know, kind of what are some sort of smart, should he be during thaws and whatever, should he be looking at it, watering it, you know, kind of when, how long do you water, I guess?
Well, that's a good question. I think you water until the plants are dormant.
Right.
And they're probably not evergreen plants. So I was going to say until the ground freezes, but I don't even think that. I think until the plants go dormant.
Mm-hmm.
So probably into October, the last watering, if you have a dry October especially.
Right. Where we are, I mean, it's November, you know, late November, early December, whatever, when this is airing, and, you know, it's not going to be, the ground may not even be frozen, so, but the plants may be dormant. So you're saying take the cue from the plant. If it looks like it could still be up and growing, you want to make sure it doesn't dry out. But once it's gone dormant, you're not as worried.
Right, and the ground tends to sort of stay moist, too, at that time, at this time of year.
Right. So related, maybe, question, Linda on Facebook asked about sugar maples. She has a sugar maple that is not an alien maple species. She'd be interested in the best ground cover plant to try on a steep piece of hillside. I get a lot of questions about steep spots. And it's shaded by this sugar maple. The grass is dead. You know, maybe there's some moss around. But, like, she's down to kind of bare dirt. And it's in this kind of wild part of her yard. So she's most interested in natives. Do you have some sort of favorite for a steep spot like that, ground covery kind of natives that you'd like to use?
Your description of it sounds pretty. more moss and rocks and maybe some snowdrops and leave it at that. But I know that's not the question.
Those are not natives, but something to hold the steep site, yeah.
Try Pachysandra procumbens.
The native Pachysandra would be nice.
Native Pachysandra. And again, the polygonatums, and they're deciduous, but that's something. And I think the Christmas fern, even though it takes a while, maybe you can buy a larger plant, some other ferns too, but Christmas fern's great because it is sort of evergreen. I mean, it looks okay until February.
Right.
And then it pushes new growth in the spring anyway. But that's a good drought-tolerant, tough plant once established. And I think that would look pretty good under a sugar maple.
Okay. Jai on Facebook is asking about dry shade and wants to know about, have we grown any carex, the genus carex, the sedges, grassy looking but not grasses. And he is wondering, natives, non-natives, are they invasive, how to get started? You probably have grown more of them. I have a lot of native ones around the edge of my property. But any thoughts there? I have some thoughts, but do you have any thoughts?
I love the carex. And it's sort of like, you know, in the movie The Graduate, when they said one word, plastics. Well, I have one word for you, carex, sedges.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's so many new ones coming out, and they're so beautiful. Now, I've heard that carex flauca, I think that's what it is, can be invasive. And I've heard that there's another one I can't remember. Kobomuki, which is a Japanese one, can be invasive too. But I have a carex flauca. Maybe you've seen it, blue zinger. It's about, I don't know, 8 inches across. 5 years. It's 8 inches across. So I don't know how this thing would become invasive. It doesn't really move.
So some do, some don't. Some spread more than others.
I think Carex pennsylvanica, which is a native for us.
Right.
It sort of spreads gently like a grass might. It's certainly not difficult to control, although you wouldn't want to. It's like if you have an area where you would like something that waves in the breeze and it's almost like a lawn and you don't want to have to even mow it. It's beautiful and green. Carex pennsylvanica is great. But I think there's a lot of Carex. There's Carex apalachica. I don't know if you've seen it. It looks like a little dwarf cousin it, little mop head. And I have some of those planted under a maple and also at the base of an ash tree. We still have ash trees here. And they're just doing fine. They really don't move that much. I should probably divide them if I want to get more. But they're just swell.
So the suggestion I would have is that some of the wholesalers that specialize in either natives or in grasses and sedges, there's two of them that I love to look at the lists, and they actually note which ones are native and which ones aren't.
North Creek Nursery.
North Creek Nurseries is one, and you can't buy from these. These are wholesalers, but they have great lists, and I'll give the link to that. And then Hoffman Nursery as well, and they even have like a whole PDF that you can download a comparison chart of all the natives and non-natives and their growth habits and so forth. So I think that looking at those kinds of big sellers of them and then finding out what local nurseries in your area they sell to, if they do, but sort of getting some clues from lists like that might be a way to begin.
You'll see pictures of everything. And North Creek also has, you can click on retail sources.
Exactly. That's what I mean. Yeah, exactly.
And it shows you where you can get them, right?
Yeah. So vegetables. Rosa on Facebook wants to know, are there any vegetables and herbs that will grow in the full shade or in part shade? And, what type of light? And Marty, also on Facebook, was thinking about growing broccoli on the northwest side of the garage and worrying about in the shade, are slugs going to have a better chance of causing havoc? So a couple of vegetable garden questions. And I always think, if you have less than full sun, you don't want to really struggle with like eggplants and tomatoes and peppers and so forth, the things that are trying to make a big fruit. But you want to do more your sort of leafy and root things like your leafy greens, kale and chard and salads and spinach, and then things that are, again, roots like beets and radishes. Rhubarb, I don't think, needs a ton of light. I've grown parsley in the shade of other things, but not the dark. I don't think stuff is going to grow in the dark.
No? Maybe mushrooms.
Yeah, well, one could do that, indeed. One could do
maybe.
That.
Maybe. I don't even know that. You ask those questions, and the answers are no, 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 maybe, and no.
Oh, thank you very much. I'll just check that off. but seriously, I mean, and morning sun is generally less intense than afternoon sun and how many hours and so forth. But if you don't have 6 hours of full sun, I wouldn't do the sort of heat-loving, the real intense, again, the ones that are trying to make the big fruits like the tomatoes and the eggplants and the peppers and so forth.
It's funny that you're saying that because in 6 hours of sun or even a little bit less, I have grown winter squash, butternut squash. Mm-hmm. But, you get three fruits, you can go to the store and buy three fruits.
Right. And I have like a squash patch that's maybe 10 by 10, and I got 35 giant butternuts out of it. Do you know? Because it was in the sun. It's in full sun.
Right.
And I had three hills, and I got, 100 something pounds of butternut. So for the whole year. So,
I do grow Frigeria vesca, the alpine strawberries. I've been growing them in pots just because it's easy and they're hardy. But I grow those in some shade, and that's something you can't get at the market. Of course, they yield like a tablespoonful of strawberries.
I know, it's funny.
But that's enough for cereal.
So that's another one.
And they're
one.
Pretty.
So we have only a couple of minutes left, and I just want to ask a question of my own, Ken. Are there shade plants that when you did that first book that we were talking at the beginning of the program that you coveted and you cultivated that you're now sort of excommunicating from your garden? Because I know that is one of the things, the big changes in my garden, is that some of my earliest shade plants that were sort of connoisseur gorgeous are now thugs. I know them to be thugs. A lot has changed in that time. Is there anything you're getting rid of?
Wow, you're putting me on the spot.
I was just curious if there's anything that you wish you hadn't planted or you know, I mean, look, you know, Hotunia, the chameleon plant, it's terrible.
I didn't plant it.
The worst weed ever. And it was, you know, everyone wanted, you know, it was beautiful right. looking then, right? So it's hard to get rid of. And I'll give a link if people don't know what that is. And, you know, I mentioned them before, the yellow archangels or whatever they're called, Lamiastrum galeobdalin, right? You know, terrible thug. I wish I hadn't planted those. I was just curious if you had any. Just last 2 seconds, just tell me.
I can't think of anything offhand. And it's funny that you're saying this because we really were sticking with native plants, but for dry shade and shade tolerant and even blooming, hellebores. And we True. Didn't mention it.
True.
But it's funny that you're asking me about regrets. And I'm okay so far. But I used to, when I first got hellebores and they were so expensive, I would work so hard to grow them from seed and it was a lot of work and you had to do warm and cold and cold and warm and wet. And then after about 3 or 4 years, I was looking under the leaves and there's babies everywhere.
Exactly. Very productive.
So that's actually maybe a problem for the future. I've been, you know, it breaks your heart to pull them out and throw them away, but I've been pulling them out and throwing them away. And I think if I wasn't careful, that could be a problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, on that note, thank you, Ken, as always. I will talk to you again soon. Yes, yes?
My super pleasure. Okay. It's always a pleasure.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach made possible from High Mowing Organic Seeds, the first independently owned farm-based seed company broadly serving organic gardeners and farmers with 100% organic and non-GMO vegetable, herb, and flower seeds. HighMowingSeeds.com/A Way to Garden. From Timber Press, the leader in fine garden books. The World of Laura Ingalls Wilder by best-selling author Marta McDowell. The revealing exploration of Wilder's connection to the landscapes of the American frontier is a must-read for Little House on the Prairie fans. From booksellers everywhere.
Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden. And happy gardening meantime.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.